Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence. The man at the center of a legal tug-of-war between the state and federal governments over the death penalty is scheduled to enter a plea today that will send him to prison for the rest of his life. As Rhode Island Public Radio's Flo Jonick reports, Jason Plew has agreed to change his plea to avoid capital punishment.
Nearly 3 years ago, Jason Plew shot Woonsocket gas station manager David Main in the head and stole $12,000 from him. Today, Plew is scheduled to plead guilty to robbery, conspiracy, and using a firearm in a crime of violence. Plew has been at the center of a legal custody battle between the U.S. government, which wanted to seek the death penalty, and the state of Rhode Island, which repudiated capital punishment long ago. The state lost that battle, but in the end, federal prosecutors agreed to drop their demand for the death penalty in exchange for life in prison without parole. Both sides have agreed to that sentence. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Governor Lincoln Chafee's administration plans to launch a search for a new state commissioner of higher education. Chafee's choice for the post, Eva Marie Mancuso, is dropping her request for a state ethics commission waiver that would allow her to move into the job. Instead, a veteran state employee, Clark Green, will be temporarily loaned to the Office of Higher Education. Mancuso will remain as chairwoman of the state board overseeing K through 12 and higher education.
I'm going to call an emergency board meeting within the next 2 weeks so that the board can sign on to this leadership as we begin our process to find a new full-time commissioner for higher education.
Rhode Island's current commissioner of higher ed, Raymond DePasquale, is due to leave the post September 30th. Meanwhile, thanks to a plan backed by the General Assembly, the State Office of Higher Education will lose its funding at the end of December. A prominent out-of-town venture capitalist says cities like Providence should build their entrepreneurial communities without trying to replicate Silicon Valley. As Rhode Island Public Radio's Ian Donis reports, Josh Kopelman spoke to dozens of entrepreneurs yesterday at the startup incubator Beta Spring.
Philadelphia-based venture capitalist Josh Kopelman says just because his city has a great Chinatown, that doesn't mean it should try to become China. Rather, Kopelman says, the question is, how do cities make a better, more vibrant startup community? That message resonated with Beta Spring's managing partner, Alan Teer.
We can be the best entrepreneurial community that we can be without trying to become San Francisco. And I think you made some great points as well about how public sector officials can make a difference both by removing friction, but also using their public audience to celebrate success.
Kopelman was invited to speak by local tech entrepreneur Angus Davis, whose payment processing company, Swipely, is one of Providence's most successful startups. Kopelman says a single very successful company is a key for launching other lucrative startups. Ian Donis, Rhode Island Public Radio.
And a mural along the busy Eddy Street Interstate 95 underpass was officially unveiled yesterday. It marks the 150th anniversary of Rhode Island Hospital. It took artist Ken Spicer and his team nearly 3 weeks to paint the pair of 300-foot-long walls. The biggest challenge, he says, moisture and noise.
It's a very wet environment. The highway from above weeps down and makes the wall quite wet. And it's very loud. We get a lot of ambulances, and we got a lot of sirens, and we get a lot of motorcycles and truckers.
The mural features long waves with dolphins, whales, harbor seals, and an octopus. Spicer says the waves are designed to have a calming effect on drivers. I'm Elizabeth Harrison. This is Rhode Island Public Radio, Rhode Island's NPR. Rhode Island's Governor Lincoln Chafee is withdrawing his pick for an interim higher education commissioner after ethics concerns were raised about the candidate. The nominee was State Education Board Chair Eva Marie Mancuso, who had applied for a waiver from the State Ethics Commission. She says she's now withdrawn that application. Here to talk more about what this all means is Rhode Island Public Radio's political analyst Scott McKay. Welcome, Scott.
Hello, Elizabeth.
So, Scott, what exactly were the concerns about Eva Marie Mancuso taking over the Department of Higher Education?
Well, some history is relevant here. You have to go back to the 1990s and the state credit union collapse to kind of put this in context. And what happened then was there were a bunch of scandals in state government, and the idea was to stop the trend, particularly of legislators, going in, taking state jobs. People on state boards serve for a few years, get to know everybody, schmooze a little bit, and then grab a high salary. A lot of this insider kind of dealing had really hurt the state, and the feeling was we're not going to allow this anymore. So they passed the so-called revolving door provision. Now, it hasn't stopped people from spinning that door, but it makes them wait longer. You have to wait at least a year, for instance, to leave the legislature to start going back to the assembly, the state house, and lobbying is a good example. If you want to become a judge, you have another year waiting period. So it was a well-intentioned kind of law.
And this revolving door rule applies not just to legislators, but to people serving on public boards.
Yes, and the idea, again, was to cut back on some of the insider dealing that in those days was seen as a problem for an incestuous Smith Hill culture that had caused some real ethical lapses. The fact is that in Rhode Island and a lot of other states, we don't seem to react to ethics movements unless there's a scandal.
And given this revolving door rule, Scott, why did the governor nominate Eva Marie Mancuso? She's the chair of the State Board of Education, the very same board that would have to approve her nomination.
Somebody dropped the ball in the governor's office. And, you know, Mancuso's not blameless here either. She's lived here all her life. She's a well-regarded lawyer, and she should have known about this. I mean, the way this comes out is a conservative blogger, Justin Katz, who's a sometime contributor to our political roundtable show, had to point this out to the administration. The governor, I think, was off sailing. It was right at the end of the legislative session. He took a few days vacation. Somebody in the office obviously did not do the proper vetting of this candidate, looking into the background and checking the law.
But Scott Chafee stood by his pick at first, saying Eva Marie Mancuso is the right person at the right time. Even yesterday, he said he likes consistency. So, Scott, why is he now backing down?
Well, because this is what always happens when this kind of an appointment turns into a media frittata. The local chattering classes end up talking more about the controversy, and then the candidate becomes a distraction. And what this does is you have controversy overtaking the substance, and pretty soon it's just not worth it any longer to push for a candidate, particularly when you probably got some intelligence that says the Ethics Commission is not going to look, on this with favor, and that means it's going to take 2, 3, or 4 meetings, and you're going to drag this out for a couple of months, and frankly, nothing's going to get done in the office.
I'm speaking with Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay about leadership troubles at the Rhode Island Department of Higher Education. Scott, Governor Lincoln Chafee now says Mancuso will stay in her role as chair of the State Board of Education, and he wants a full search for a new commissioner of higher education. But there's a catch here. Lawmakers have voted to stop funding the Department of Education at the end of December. Why did they do that?
You know, I can't figure out why they blew up two boards. We had two separate boards, one for K through 12, one for higher ed. They just at the end of the last legislative session last year, without a whole lot of study and discussion, they just split this thing up and decided to cut it. I don't think this was well thought out, and it's going to be very difficult to find a new commissioner. Don't forget, in 2009, when Jack Warner left, a search did not turn up a strong candidate. And also, we're coming into the 2014 gubernatorial election cycle. And you know what that means at the State House? Nothing of substance much gets done because everybody's looking over their shoulder to see who the next boss is going to be.
And Scott, even if the board does a full search, I mean, what's the likelihood they would even find a candidate willing to take a job running an office about to be defunded?
Yes, and in the last year of the term of a governor whose poll numbers aren't very high, it doesn't look like a place with a lot of job security. So I would be surprised if a really strong candidate wanted to apply.
So in the meantime, Governor Lincoln Chafee is suggesting a fix. He wants Clark Green, the current chief of staff at the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, to run the Department of Higher Education. Scott, what can you tell me about Clark Green? Does he strike you as a good pick?
Yes, because he's a very steady hand at the tiller. He's been around state government since Governor Lincoln Allman's administration back in the 1990s. He was very, very pivotal in welfare reform. He's basically a smart bureaucrat, if you understand my drift here. He understands how the government works, has pretty good relations at the State House, and I think as far as an interim pick, you probably couldn't find anyone better within the education bureaucracy.
And what about the current interim commissioner of higher education, Ray DePasquale? He's also the president of Rhode Island's community college system, and he's supposed to return to doing that full-time while still retaining his current salary of about $265,000 a year. Is that a fair deal?
Well, you know, Rhode Island, you know, somebody who makes too much money is somebody who makes more money than me. I'm not sure what his salary compares to with other presidents of community colleges of that size, but certainly the sad thing about this is the whole system really requires some leadership. I mean, I think if you look at CCRI, they're trying to be more receptive to the business community and turn out students who can take the jobs. You look at this University of Rhode Island, Rhode Island College Nursing School, finally it looks like they're going to get together and have a joint nursing school in Providence in the Dynamo Building in the Jewelry District. Someone has to shepherd that to fruition. Still issues hanging out at URI, the professors' union, negotiated a pay raise. That's been held up for more than a year. I mean, there are serious education issues in the state in higher ed, and hopefully there'll be somebody around to shepherd them.
And Scott, what do you think? Does Rhode Island really need an Office of Higher Education and a full-time commissioner?
That's a very good question. I think we have to look not just at the personalities, but we have to look at the larger questions, and someone has to deal with this. And I don't see anybody in the General Assembly doing that. One, why is the University of Connecticut, University of Massachusetts have so much lower rates of in-state tuition than Rhode Island? Why have our economic competitors in Connecticut and Massachusetts over the last, I'd say, 15 years invested more money in their state university systems than we have here in Rhode Island? And, of course, that's going to hurt our ability here in Rhode Island to attract students.
Well, Scott McKay is Rhode Island Public Radio's political analyst. Thank you, Scott, so much for being here this morning.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Education reporting on Rhode Island Public Radio is funded in part by a grant from the Rhode Island Foundation, Rhode Island's only community foundation.
I'm here with Tenny Gross, Executive Director of the Institute for the Study and Practice of Nonviolence. Tenny, your organization focuses on bringing gang violence down through outreach, working in schools, hospitals, and on the streets. Providence sees a rise in crime in the summer months. Based on what your people are hearing, what's happening in the summer that causes that increase in all sorts of crime, not just violent ones?
Well, usually school's out. People have more time, idle time. It's hot. Some people don't stay in their houses if they don't have air conditioning, etc. There's more opportunities to seek your opponents, to get into trouble, to drink. Maybe it's hard, cool yourself down, and then you do really silly choices with females and males, with other people, with rival get into fights. So we see a spike usually in the summer.
So we're looking at crime in Providence through the lens of what happened last July, where crime happened and what changed. And what police data found was that the highest number of crimes happened in the Smith Hill, Elmhurst, North End neighborhoods. But that was last year. Now we're hearing from you and your people that gang violence is down in that area. So what happened over the past year?
We had a collusion of a few things. We had two gangs that partially were, some of them were Africans that were finishing off really a few years of conflict, and that was sort of the tail end of that. You have sometimes students who are lingering, and that generates its own issues. And then just really a few individuals. Sometimes there was a bit of a spark potentially also with the old rivalry with around Camp Street area, which has died down. It's nothing compared to what Chad and the East Side used to be, and there was a little bit of that. And that's sort of what we saw.
Old beefs being settled and people moving on?
Yes, and also we had a bit of two Asian gangs, Laos Pride and Asian Boys, AB, around Smith Hill. That's something we worked very hard on in the last 8-7 years. And we got good results, and there was a bit of a flare-up. I'm glad that this year it's been a lot quieter. Someone came out of jail last year, and it sort of re-erupted. It was one person, but it got two groups ignited. That's all it needs. And it took us a few months to calm it down, us, the police, and others to calm it down. We got a few of the young people from there hired and actually moved out of state on jobs. So it takes a little planning and a little seeing what is the conflict about, who is involved, what drives it, who drives it. And between the police making their arrests when they can and us offering opportunities when people are willing, between those two, it calmed down again.
So if gang violence and gun violence is dropping in the Smith Hill area due to sort of this dissipation of the gangs, where is it moving to?
So it's moving to it. Some people have flare-ups again. Hartford had its own issues that we were concerned about. There's a nightclub on the south side of Providence that both the police, the club license, and the institute were worried about already in the winter. It's Ada's Creation, and we need to pay a lot of attention there. That brought together about three gangs that we managed to mediate. It's a very serious conflict 3 and 4 years ago. But there's flare-ups when they meet at Ada's Creation at the nightclub there at Ada's. So that needs to be addressed. We're working on it now. We're applying pressure.
We're talking with Tenny Gross, Executive Director of the Institute for the Study and Practice of Nonviolence. Whether it's Smith Hill, Elmhurst, or South Providence, what are you and your people hearing about the relationship between police and the people who live in these communities?
I think the Providence Police has made great strides in the last 8 years or so in opening itself to the community, having community partners involved in decisions. But there's still a long way to go. People are afraid to testify. Just, you know, the American legal system in its all its glory allows a defendant to find out who is accusing them. That's a beautiful thing, but it does cause fear. I'm not, by all means, I think we have to keep it. It's one of the bases of this society. It's not like in a dictatorship when you don't know who accuses you. But that creates a fundamental problem if people have used violence and that's people are intimidated. And working on that again, just like Institute works on reducing violence through relationship, the police has to always double up and work strongly on relationship with victims' families, etc. The Institute works with every shooting or homicide victim in the state, and we really see how important it is to develop relationships, support families, etc.
Speaking of communication, at the press conference where police announced the arrest of two suspects in the shooting death of a 12-year-old girl, Police Chief Clements and Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Perry both stressed that they got little to no help from the community. Are these residents afraid to talk? Is that the issue?
Yes. I mean, I think the commissioner particularly has been very vocal and constantly in every opportunity he gets, whether it's showing off guns that were bought in a buyback or a high-profile arrest, to appeal to the community. I think that's the right term. We don't want to blame the community. I think we want to appeal to the community to work more with the police, use tip lines, use relationship. It takes two to tango. The police really needs to make sure they're doing everything they can. And leaders in the community, whether it's churches and others, really need to stress with the community that the police is not the enemy, and we cannot allow crime to happen because then more of it will happen.
And it's not fair to say that these people don't want to cooperate with police. Really, this is about their basic safety. They live in these neighborhoods. People know where they live. There's a lot of fear, it seems.
People do need to stand up. There are people in the community who tell young people, you will commit something, I will tell on you. And if enough people did that, people will not do it.
So how do you get people to talk?
I think it's a lot of discussions. We have here at the Institute now three summer programs. We have year-round employment for former gang members. We have summer program for young adults who are really at risk. And we have a camp for young kids. We introduce police officers to them. We talk with them about nonviolence. We talk about right and wrong. And I think I've done it now for 25 years. I'm a very strong believer, and research supports me, that conversation, legitimacy, giving people heads up. We're coming after you. Communicating with people seriously and honestly, being transparent, is the best way I know how to deal with that.
Tenny Gross, Executive Director of the Institute for the Study and Practice of Nonviolence, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much for caring about this issue.
I believe that even though we don't always get what we want, we do get what we need.
I believe in mentors. I believe that everybody who is different still has a chance.
This I believe.
I'm Frederick Reamer, host of This I Believe Rhode Island. Have you noticed that sometimes food is much more than, well, food? Sometimes food connects us to special events and people in our lives, helping to shape the people we become. As the French novelist Marcel Proust said in Remembrance of Things Past, the smell and taste of things remain poised for a long time, like souls ready to remind us. And that's what comes to mind in this week's essay by Catherine Egan.
Every day for the 12 years of my public school education, my father made a lunch for me. Each morning, I would breeze into the kitchen and find him midway through the family lunch assembly line. Four sets of bread would be lined up, open-faced on the kitchen counter with various layers of ham and cheese. Without fail, Dad would look up, smile, and say, "Hey, kiddo," before delving back into the serious business of prepping lunch for me, my siblings, and himself. After the lunches were assembled, Dad lined each one up in a paper bag. As I got older and my taste became more exotic, simple ham and cheese was replaced by turkey with balsamic dressing on a wheat wrap or carrot sticks with hummus. But the morning ritual of chatting with my father as he made my lunch remained an unchanging aspect of my adolescence. The night before my last day of high school, Dad asked me what I would like to take for lunch. "It's a big one," he joked. "It might be the last lunch I ever make for you." At that moment, I realized that the seniors would be having a barbecue the next day, meaning that I had already eaten the last lunch my father would make for me. When I shared this revelation with my dad, we both burst into tears. I believe these brown bag lunches were not only the bridge between the comfort of home and the hectic school day, they also built a bridge between me and my dad. Sometimes Dad tucked into the bag notes reading, "Go get 'em," if I had a biology test or a presentation in English. Though I was quick to stuff these notes in my pocket before my friends could see them, my father's lunches were a consistency that I came to cherish. Never mind that my friends either made their own, took lunch money, or had their moms make their lunches. I knew that Dad's lunches were a sign that I was blessed with the constant love that every child deserves. Years after the eve of my last day in high school, I moved back in with my parents to save money while in graduate school. At 22 years old, I knew I was old enough to make my own lunch, but I couldn't help but feel lucky every morning when I came downstairs to find a fresh pot of coffee with a note reading, "Good luck out there. Love, Dad."
Catherine Egan is an English teacher at North Smithfield High School. She wrote this essay after challenging her own students to write their This I Believe essays. And she reports she now lives independently in Providence, out of her parents' house, where she successfully makes her own lunch and coffee every single day. To offer your own essay or to listen to previous segments, we invite you to visit the This I Believe Rhode Island page of our website, ripr.org. For Rhode Island Public Radio, this is Frederick Reamer.